Good morning, everyone, and thank you very much for coming along this morning. I'm Michael Green, the clerk of Green's List at the Bar. This morning is our last CPD function for this CPD year, says he with a sigh of relief, early mornings and late nights. It's, as you know, the Resilient Lawyer. It comes under the heading of Professional Skills. And our presenters are Mark Raymond and Kath McCarthy. Mark and Kath are both highly trained professionals in the area of practice development, the area of, general skills within running a business or a legal practice. Mark comes from a business background and Kath comes from a legal background. I'm not going to go through their individual achievements, but there are pages in the handout there so you can read about them. Between them, they consult to government departments, large businesses, legal firms, government agencies, etc. They cover in areas of leadership, in areas of change, in areas of business development. So they come highly qualified to us. And I just like to give them a bit of a plug, really, that it's not they just don't stand up here and speak on our behalf, but they both run businesses and therefore they're both available to provide their skills to your practices if you need them. And in saying that, I'd also say that we put our money where our mouth is, because both Mark and Kath consult to our list and to our barristers in these areas. And our barristers who have taken advantage of their services both give me very good feedback on the value they get out of Mark's services and Kath's services. So that's my plug on behalf of Kath and Mark. And please welcome to start with Kath McCarthy and Mark Raymond.
Thank you, Michael, for that. Kath and I are really excited to be doing this talk today. Resilience. It's a really important topic for everyone, not just lawyers. Just a quick show of hands. Who in the last 12 months has experienced no stress or very little stress? It's water off a duck's back and life's pretty good. Don, is that you? Yes, you?
Yeah.
No stress. Who's experienced some stress over the last 12 months? You know, it's overall, the year's been pretty good, particularly relating to work. That's what we're talking about today, relating to work. But, you know, some stress in the last 12 months. A show of hands. Some stress. Okay. Who has experienced a lot of stress in the last 12 months related to work? We've got one brave soul at the back. A few hands. Okay, you must all be very resilient. I think we'd invite you up the front here to run this talk today. And it's certainly one of the themes that we hear back from the legal industry is it is a stressful profession, more than most. Certainly in my practice coaching for the last 10 years, topics related to resilience and bouncing back from stress are pretty common. And one of the things that I've learned in that time is that there are some practices and habits that people can cultivate that have a big impact on managing stress and building resilience. It's not a kind of you have it or you don't have it kind of thing. There are some skills to cultivate, and that's what today's about. So this morning is really a morning of two halves. The first half, Kath's going to be talking through some very interesting research about mindset and stress and the difference a mindset makes to managing stress, and then looking at some research related to what we call the four pillars of resilience. And then we're going to have a break for coffee at 8 o'clock for about 15 minutes, and then we're going to talk about some things that you can put into practice. Some of these things you may do already, but some of the things you may not. So there are some things that you can put into practice that you can take away that we hope you'll find useful for yourself. And then we're going to have a quick conversation about what are some things that you can put into practice with other people to help build the resilience of your fellow lawyers and colleagues and make an impact for them. This is a really big topic, and we're really just scratching the surface today. But what we hope that today brings for you is a sense, a chance to reflect, to think about your own work situation and to decide whether or not you want to make any changes in the way you operate, but more a chance to reflect out of the busyness of your day-to-day and offer you some, hopefully some strategies that might come in handy. So on that note, Kath, I'll hand over to you to talk through some of the research.
Good morning. We know a lot about stress. Been studied and studied for centuries, and you know, if you go to the best library in the world, Google, type in stress, 578 million hits. Type in resilience, 38 million. What does that say about where our interest is? We know a lot about stress. It began to be studied in the 18th century by physiologists. So rather than psychs, this was a field owned by people interested in the way the body maintained itself in the face of external pressure. So physiology claimed the world of stress to begin with. And then in the middle of last century, they started being able to look at cortisone and cortisols and hormones and the adrenal cortex, and bang, psych was off. And they began to look at, well, how do we mediate stressors and cope with stressors, and what impact does that have on our bodies? So we now know lots and lots about stress. We now know that stress is associated with behaviours and emotions and physiological responses. So the behaviours that correlate with people who report high stress, and it might be some people in this room, can involve excessive drinking, that's not me, can involve aggression, sometimes withdrawal when you're really stressed. You might see it in organisations with high levels of absenteeism. It's a sign there might be a bit of stress floating around. Poor performance. People say stress is associated with a drop in your capacity to perform, even simple tasks like memory tasks. Accidents, more likely to have accidents. So these are sort of behavioural impacts of stress. And there's emotional impacts. People report not satisfied with life, and in more extreme cases, more experience of depression and anxiety. Physiological changes. So right down from that moment when your heart starts racing and you've got increased blood pressure, if you look within the body, there's cortisones and hormones that are flooding the system. So we know there's a linkage between mind and body and behaviour. No wonder it sounds like something we'd want to avoid. It's bad. It's a bad thing to experience stress. I think it's something more complex than that, though. Stress isn't always bad. I want to take you through a couple of studies that might illuminate the nuances, these nuances a bit more. And the reason why I want to do that is because until our profession, the legal profession, changes dramatically, there is going to be a lot of stress in it. So if the message that lawyers get is that stress is bad, it's a pretty depressing message, isn't it? So let's look at these nuances a bit more closely. There was a very interesting study, and it's reasonably recent given there was 30,000 participants in it. It came from America, so it was in 2012. And it tracked these 30,000 adults over an 8-year period, and they were asked two questions. The first one was, similar to what Mark asked you, how much stress have you experienced in the last year? It was a self-report. People would report on how much stress they felt they had experienced in their life, not just their work life. And then they're asked, do you believe that stress is harmful to you? Do you believe that stress is bad? The results were really surprising. It found that people who experienced a lot of stress, who said, I experienced a lot of stress in the last year, so people who put their hands up, including myself, and believed that stress was harmful, had a 43% increased chance of dying in that 8-year period. Don't worry if you put your hands up today. However, people who experienced a lot of stress in the last year, but didn't believe that stress was harmful, had the lowest risk of dying of all the stress levels. So that says something about it. So people who experience a lot of stress on both ends of the continuum, both very stressful, but something about the mindset, the beliefs about stress, mediated its physiological impact. Something was interesting in that. Another piece of research, this one came from Harvard Uni a year earlier, not such a big subject, not such a big pool of subjects. But they were asked to do a certain task. I want you to imagine the task that these subjects were asked to do, called the social stress test. So put yourself in their shoes. So imagine I asked each one of you, while you're having breakfast out there, that when you enter here, you'll be coming into a room and giving an impromptu talk on your personal weaknesses to a panel sitting up at the table. Might be Mark and Michael and myself. You'd be standing in the middle of that room, And while you're giving your 5-minute impromptu talk about your personal weaknesses, we'd be expressing great disgust, disdain, dissatisfaction with your performance through our body language. We'd be specially trained to do that. Lots of frowning and shaking of the heads and surprise. Very, very uncomfortable for you. And when you'd finish that, we'd then ask you to start at the number 996 and count backwards by sevens, and then time you and tell you you're doing a very bad job. You weren't fast enough and to go quicker. Now, I don't know, we're not very empathetic as a profession, but I could think we can imagine that would generate a certain degree of anxiety. So everyone, every one of you was put through this social stress test, but half of you were first taken away by Harvard professors and told and taught that the physiological response to stress, so heart rate going and sweating, sweaty palms and the things you might experience, is actually very healthy. And you were taught about the importance of the body, the system of the body, flooding adrenaline so that you can be prepared to rise to the challenge. And this is an adaptive response. And the reason why breathing gets faster when you're stressed is so that you have the oxygen in the brain so you can perform better. And we'll just see if there's a difference in the experience of the half of this room who were taught that and the half who weren't. And what Harvard Uni found was that those who were given the training about how to think about stress as helpful, not harmful, reported much, much lower levels of anxiety after the event, so much lower. They performed better on that maths test, so there was performance was impacted. And they actually had a lower physiological response to the stress. So their heart rate, because people were monitored, their heart rate, the normal physiological reaction to stress wasn't as evident as it was who hadn't been taught to adjust their mindset about stress. I think that's very interesting. So there's something in that that says stress can be good, depending on how you think about it. And we know this. We know that we need stress in order to perform. We need some sort of challenge to perform. And this has long been associated with the concept of eustress, which is that first half of this graph. It's in your slide pack. That to a point, stress can actually be really motivating and associated with higher levels of performance. It's when it kicks over at a certain point, and it's different for every person, and it's different for every moment for an individual person, depending on what is going on in their mind, it becomes distress. And that's when the unhealthy effects of stress kick in a lot more. Now, chronic stress in any form isn't great, not particularly good for you, but if we can help maintain stress on the left-hand side of that graph, it can be associated with our performance being a lot higher. When you get into distress, you're kicking over and your performance is being affected by the external environment. That's when we talk about resilience. We talk about strategies to bounce back. Stress is more complex, though, than just experiencing and bouncing back. There's also something to be said about the mindset we bring to the external stressors that can make that side of the graph on the left a lot bigger. So if you think of a barrel where you're putting marbles of stress in or filling it up with the water of stress, if your little container is small, it will fill up quicker and you'll slip over. The water will fall out quicker. So you'll slip over into distress more easily. If you can build up a mindset that thinks about stress differently, your container is larger. It takes longer to fill it up before you kick over into the world of distress. Does that make sense? Okay, so where's a model that can cover not only resilience, but also this concept of, it's been referred to as hardiness, sort of not language we use, but this concept that the mindset can help you make yourselves a bigger container to hold more stress and keep your performance closer to the optimum level. So you don't experience it as stress, you experience it as challenge. You experience it as something where you can rise to the occasion and perform better. I think that would be useful for lawyers until we fix the profession and not make it any level of stress. I wanted to introduce you then to this model of mental toughness, which I know some some firms are using this as a way of helping build the resilience, the resilient cultures and resilient lawyers. So it's not unfamiliar to law. This is a concept that blends resilience, which is bouncing back after you've fallen into the world of distress. So how do you bounce back? But it also speaks to the world of hardiness, which is how do you react to stress in a more adaptive way so it's not experienced as something negative, something motivating. And I want to take you through it today. It's a bit of talking at you. So the way I thought it could help you connect with the content as I go through the model, because models I find extraordinarily interesting, but I'm not assuming everyone is here to find my model as interesting as I do. So what you've got in your pack is this sort of self-rating scale. It's sometimes helpful, if, as I'm going through the denser part of the model today, for you to think of someone. It could be a child, it could be a partner, it could be yourself, it could be someone you're working with, a client, but someone you'd like to reflect on in this space and think about, how would I judge their resilience or mental toughness? And then you can bring life to this model immediately. Does that make sense? So if you have a pen, feel free as we go through, just to give a rating to each of the subdomains that I'll be talking about. Okay, this model is made up of four domains, which have two of them have subdomains. The four C's, consultants love to have patterns of four C's. Happens a lot. The four C's of control, commitment, challenge, and confidence. And it says in mindset, around each one of these components is what helps people cope with stress better, perform better, and be more resilient in the face of it. Okay, the first one, life control. Life control is one of the control domains. It's looking at the degree to which you believe you have control over your life, that you can make an impact on things. It's the belief you have about your efficacy, or your locus of control. If people have ever done psych, they might have heard those terms. Am I an actor in the world, or am I acted upon? Does the world have the control and I don't? Or am I someone who can make a big difference? And so when I go into a situation and it's potentially stressful to others, I'm not a stress bite because I say, I can make a difference here and I'm not disempowered by this situation. So people who can have a mindset that supports that way of thinking would be scoring high on life control. So I'll leave you to have a look at the highs and the lows. The low says it believes it can, belief the world, belief it happens to me. And I won't read them to you because I can't bear it when people read slides to me. And one of the things as you read through that I often see in my work in the practice development space is that last point about luck. You know, you do practice development and then you go and then it works and then that was lucky. Gosh, I was lucky to get that file or get that client. I see that operating a lot in lawyers. I think you do too, Mark. So that often I often listen to that through this model and think, what's going on there in terms of beliefs about control in life? If you find yourself saying, I'm lucky a lot, there's sometimes a little something in that for you. So life control is important. Emotional control is probably one of the dimensions that isn't tapping into mindset as much. These have correlations with personality tests and the big five personality traits. But this and taps into emotional intelligence a bit more. So there's a lot of overlaps in this model. But this is the ability to control your emotional response. So that if you're angry, you mediate it before you express it. There's some sense of filtering before you, as you experience something, you can do something internally with your emotions before it drives your behaviour. You respond to your emotional experience rather than constantly react to it. So that anger, the emotion of anger or worry, is a trigger for reflection rather than a trigger for behaviour. There's usually a step between it. So if you look at the highs and lows of them, you get a sense of what's correlated with low scores on emotional control and high scores on emotional control. Okay, commitment. Commitment is the extent to which individuals persist in their goals or their work tasks. They have determination and beliefs. And this is, in terms of mindset that we were talking about in terms of managing stress, this is a belief is, when I start something, will I finish it? How confident am I that I'll finish it? When I make a promise, do I mean to keep it? Do I take these promises seriously? People who are high on commitment usually love goals because goals are a way of measuring the output of what they're doing. And we know from goal setting theory that if you set good goals, and good goals are things like something you want rather than something you don't want, what I mean by that, I don't like my current practice, I want a different type of practice, is called an avoidance goal. It's running away from something rather than running to something. Approach goals, goals that are more likely to generate commitment. So people high on commitment like setting goals and are usually good at them. So you've heard the term SMART goals. Sometimes they have to be takes a lot of effort to develop goals that are specific and motivating and realistic and timely because they have measurements. Some people find that really difficult to sort of set SMART goals. People high on this domain will set SMART goals more easily, sort of naturally, because they know how to do it. I'm working with my children at the moment on this element. As they're overwhelmed with homework, my son's just started year 7, and I've got this saying that I've picked up from this literature that says, how do you eat an elephant? And he comes back at me because he's learnt to, one bite at a time. So the idea that you break down tasks is how you grow this part of your mindset. Break down tasks, don't be overwhelmed by them, and you know how to commit to things and achieve them. Confidence. Confidence is two aspects of this, confidence in abilities and interpersonal confidence. Confidence in abilities is having a belief, again, that mindset might not always be true, but a mindset that you have the experience and you have the ability and you have the basic competence in terms of intelligence to be able to achieve the task. You believe in your abilities. I should say that high scores, 10s on any of these, can be as maladaptive in some ways. You might be more resilient and hardy and experience less stress, but there might be maladaptive components to very high scores you need to watch out for, as you can imagine. Overconfidence may mean someone doesn't experience a lot of stress, but they're really annoying. So remembering that high scores in this it's about mental toughness, and mental toughness isn't always something you want to be extremely good at. You know, there's other aspects of life we need to balance that with. But a high confidence in abilities, believing you're right, not needing people to tell you you're good at something, just having that belief in yourself, and it might be built from evidence that you know from experience that you have the ability to do something. When you answer questions, you're happy to give full answers because you have that knowledge that you're good at it. And critical feedback is like Teflon. You don't hear critical feedback as impacting you at a personal level. It's just information to respond to. You can see how that would generate a resilient response to life. And the mental toughness that goes with it means you can probably perform better in the face of stress than others who don't have that confidence. So it's something to be cultivated, but maybe not in the extreme case. Yeah. As with all of these. Interpersonal confidence is the other subcomponent. And this is looking at your belief in yourself. Again, it's a mindset. Your belief in your capacity to handle difficult interpersonal situations. So when things get heated, do you believe that you can map your way through it? Sometimes highly assertive people have this in spades because the way your belief in how to map difficult situations is to assert what you see is right. And so those difficult interpersonal situations aren't stressful for you or as stressful potentially. Other people just have a lot of belief in their interpersonal ability to map their way through tricky, uncomfortable situations. They know they have skills in that space. So you can see, if you have this confidence in yourself, interpersonal situations that would be stressful to others are less stressful to you. They're not seen as stressful, they just are. They're just part of life. So you're into that hardiness space. Yeah? Challenge is the last subdomain, and this is where we'll close before we have a break for breakfast. But challenge is looking at the belief to which someone likes to view external stressors as a challenge and an opportunity rather than a threat. So someone high in this aspect of mental toughness, this model, would be always looking for the next opportunity to prove themselves and set really large goals and not be intimidated by that because it's an opportunity to perform, and would talk in terms of challenge rather than, oh, this is really difficult, oh, this is really challenging. They'll use different language. Competition is motivating and energising for them, so stretch goals are great. So you can imagine, combined with commitment and challenge, people who have high on both of these would persist for a long time at a task when others give up. And we know persistence is highly correlated with resilience. We know that from the positive psych literature. So if you think of a challenge like giving a presentation, if someone thinks of that as a really uncomfortable experience of speaking in front of groups, I know that's a very common one. And if some people see that as a challenge, that's not going to be a stressful experience for them. So they're in the space of hardiness. They don't even get anywhere near resilience of having to cope with stress. So sometimes the mindset and the way you talk to yourself about the external stressors can impact on that. Okay. So, what's the evidence that this model is anything better than a good idea? There's a lot of models that are good ideas that consultants think. This summarises the experience of my practice. Why I wanted to bring it to you and why I brought emotional intelligence to you last year was that there's a lot of robustness around this model, because unlike a lot of models, there's a valid and reliable way of measuring it. There's an internationally accepted test that people can take, and it gives a measure of a person's mental toughness that is repeatable. So if the test is taken in a couple of months' time, people score the same in a couple of years' time. So there's a sense of this is a valid and reliable measure of this mindset. And once you've got a test, then you can seek evidence for whether there's support for this concept out there in the bigger world. So I've got up there some of the results of studies that have used the test for mental toughness upon which this model is based and looked for correlations. So you can assess for yourselves whether it's something you'd want to strive for rather than something that just makes sense. So the high scores of mental toughness, and remember, high scores do carry risks in themselves, but high scores are associated with some socially positive outcomes. People report higher well-being, so a sense of enjoying life a lot more in the moment. There's lower in organisations that have high mental toughness, a proportion of high mentally tough individuals, people who score high on the test, there's less absenteeism. People are turning up to work a lot more if they're tougher. It makes sense if they're resilient. They'll be turning up and coping with the demands of a workplace. There's higher quantity, so volume of work is higher, and quality of work is judged as higher for people with higher levels of mental toughness on this measure. So there's some performance outcomes that we can look at. There is more resilience, so recovering from setbacks, which are inevitable. So the resilience piece is also ticked off by people who are higher in mental toughness. There's often a sense of greater goals, more ambitious goals being set at a career level. So when you set bigger goals, there are bigger risks associated with that. It makes sense that someone with higher levels of mental toughness would pursue stretch goals more readily than someone who is going to be protecting themselves by setting lower goals. So more risk-taking, more ambition, because they'll back themselves if they don't achieve it, they'll probably be okay. They'll probably back themselves, they will achieve it. And if they don't, they'll bounce back more quickly. And better equipped to produce performance under pressure. This was a study that looked at the sporting realm. So one of the kickers in rugby, I don't know much about rugby, but apparently someone kicks the ball through the goals at some point, and this is a very important position. I don't know. But they tested a lot of these people, and the ones who had mental toughness got more goals through the posts than others. So in that key moment where it's a highly pressured position, mentally tough athletes had better performance on the sporting field for that discrete task than others. There's a lot to be said for it. So what we want to do is break now for breakfast while you marinate in the world of mental toughness, and come back and walk through a couple of strategies that have been associated with building it. So I'm assuming it's going to be socially desirable to develop it, so the question after the break will be how to.